Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Tom Ackerman. There are not many people on the planet, let alone here in St. Louis, who can say that they grew up in a town, became a baseball player for their favorite team, and won a world championship. In fact, only a handful of people can do that. And here in St. Louis, that has certainly come true for some people that we are connected with. We're very fortunate to know them, and we're very fortunate that this man works with us. He is Kyle McClellan, and he is doing some great work for St. Louis. In fact, his journey has just begun in that regard. We have him next in this edition of KMOX Profiles.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
And we are joined by Kyle McClellan. It is always great to spend time with you. We talk a lot of ball. Have you enjoyed this radio thing, this portion of your career? You like this?
Yeah, it's been good. You know, the thing I like most about it is how I've been able to be flexible with my schedule and a lot of the other things I do. And being able to do a lot of it from my phone, it has been really allowed me to be able to, call in and be a part of KMOX almost every day. You know, driving down here to the studio would be a lot more challenging, and not sure if it would fit my schedule. So this has been it's been great. It's been good to stay connected with the team and be able to share kind of my insights and knowledge and also, you know, be able to do the other things that I'm doing.
It is a lot of fun to do games with you, too. We get to do some games down in spring training, report on the team together, and then get up to St. Louis and spend time around the club. You are on every pregame show on the Cardinals Radio Network. You're part of our Total Information AM crew, appearing on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You're on Sunday with Mike Kelly. You pop on Sports Open Line with Chris Raby. It's Kyle McClellan, man, if we need some perspective. And you know what's cool about it is that when we need to know from a former player, but in your case, recently a former player, give you a chance to really understand today's game. And you served a lot of roles, actually, as a player, because you understood the economics of the game as a player representative and also as a world champion pitcher for this team, both as a reliever and a starter. You served a lot of roles.
Yeah, I mean, there's a, you know, on the pitching side, obviously the starter and reliever side, there's a lot of differences. Been able to live through those and kind of understand different perspectives there. Like I said, the player rep side, I was on the negotiating committee that negotiated a CBA in 2011. And so you kind of understand the back side of things. And the game has changed a lot in the last 5 years since I've been out. It's changed a ton. Analytics were kind of creeping in. Now they are fully in on every organization. The way that players are evaluated, the way that games are executed, strategy, things like that. So there has been a lot of changes, but I think that's why being down in spring training the whole time and being around it more on a day-to-day basis has really helped me kind of stay up on that. But there's also some things I watch and I'm like, man, I don't know. It's just the game's changing. I mean, you know, this pace of game, this all these different talks. I mean, they are constantly making tweaks to this game, and good or bad, you know, I don't know. I think everybody has their own opinion about it. You hear about the DH possibly coming to the National League, and there's some of these big changes that the new commissioner of baseball has put in, and they're trying to reach a new generation of people. So it's always changing, always trying to stay up on it, but it definitely keeps you entertained.
Do you miss playing?
I don't.
It's a grind, isn't it?
Yeah, it's people ask me that all the time. They said, "Do you miss it?" And I said, "No, I don't miss it. I had a great run. It's a lot of time away from the family. It's the mental side of things that you go through on a yearly basis, the day-to-day grind of the ups and downs and dealing with that. And then for me, it was mostly the physical side. I mean, once I got towards the end, waking up in pain every day and throwing with pain and trying to manage pain while you're going through is something I don't miss. I get to wake up now and take my kids to practice, you know, soccer practice and baseball practice and all their different activities. I get to be there for that. I don't have the stress when I wake up like I had when I was playing. But it was a good run, and I miss there's definitely a lot of things I miss about it, but you know, I don't feel like I walked away from the game and left anything on the table and anything to be desired for.
You still get to experience it, of course, being around the ballpark and being around the game. Do you see the game any differently than you did?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, you watch some of these young guys come up, and I can put myself exactly where they were. And you can, it's kind of like a, you know, being a parent. You see things for your kids, but they have to learn it. You know, they have to make some mistakes and they have to go through that. And so I feel like, you know, sometimes when I'm doing the analysis stuff and talking about it, I try to take that approach of, you know, you have a young guy and he made some mistakes and you go out there, that's part of it. I'm more looking at the long term, at the career wise, instead of just today's game, you know. And I think I take that approach because I see progress in these guys and what they can be and what they will be in the future if they continue to make these adjustments. And so, yeah, I think you look at it more. I feel like when I was done, when I was forced out of the game due to injuries, I was mentally and psychologically the best part of my game. Like, I understood it. I knew exactly what I had to do. I knew how to read hitters. I knew how to set it up. That took 6 years to get to that point, and I just wasn't able to perform. And the frustrating thing is I feel like if I could have physically been able to do it, I still had some really, really good years ahead of me that I could have been really successful, but that wasn't the case. But I still feel like I get to use that now when I'm watching some of these young guys and older guys going through this and always making adjustments.
You just hit on something that I always say on the air, and I didn't play the game at that level, so I rely on people like you who have played the game to tell me this, and I hear this over and over. So, you know, my job is to relay this and tell stories about the game, is that it takes a long time to understand how to pitch in the big leagues. You can have stuff, you can look great, but to understand how to pitch in the big leagues, there is so much. I mean, learning how to deal with failure,
mm-hmm.
learning how to prepare, learning how to overcome injuries, all that stuff's going to happen to you, isn't it?
And it's not just pitching. I mean, you know, hitters are trying, they're seeing it the other way. They understand, they have to learn how they're being pitched to and how to make adjustments. It's all about recognizing. And, you know, George Kissel told me this my first spring training. I was down there. He was watching me throw a bullpen. I was in extended spring training. Chris Carpenter was throwing a bullpen next to me, and he was just coming back from shoulder surgery in 2004. And I'm watching Carp throw, and I mean, his catcher's set up, and he's just hitting them every time. My catcher's all over the place. I'm bouncing balls. I'm throwing them over the screen, like, you know, just inconsistent. He said, "You know the difference between you and him?" And I'm thinking, yeah, there's a lot of difference between me and him. He said, "It's consistency." He said, "He can do things 9 out of 10 times or 10 out of 10 times where you can only do them 1 out of 10. And he said, when you leave rookie ball and you get to A ball, you might be able to do them 2 out of 10. And then when you get to high A, you can do them 3 out of 10 and you so forth and so forth. And when you get to the big leagues, you're supposed to do those things all the time. And so you can consistently go out and do them, but then you have to make those adjustments. When pitchers are adjusting to you or hitters are adjusting to the pitcher, you have to be willing to sit back and say, I recognize what's going on. I have to go out there and tweak that, change my game plan. That's hard to do. And that's the difference between a AAA player and a major league player. And that's where I feel like I really, you know, started to kind of figure it out. I understood myself as a pitcher, what pitches worked after what pitches. For instance, sometimes a changeup after a curveball wasn't good, but maybe a curveball then a changeup, or a changeup then a curveball was good. So, you know, you're constantly tweaking those mixtures and those pitches and how they work and how they react, you know, cutter in and then change up away instead of cutter in and fastball in, you know, working on how those pitches all play off each other. I feel like I kind of hit my stride but it's fun to watch those young guys start to figure that out. And, you know, we watch a guy like Jordan Hicks or Carlos Martinez who have unbelievable stuff that I never dreamed of having. And then to watch them learn how to use that and learn how to grow into being a dominant pitcher is what I enjoy the most now about watching games.
What an incredible luxury and opportunity to have Yadier Molina catching them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of things easier. You know, all these young guys that come up, they don't have to think about too much. You know, he's going to do all the thinking for you. Now, you got to be able to execute, and he's going to push you. I wasn't ready when I came from double A, I skipped triple A, came to the big leagues, and there was things that I wasn't ready to do because I hadn't learned those lessons in triple A, and he made me do them. And it was either you can do them or you can't. And if you can't, you're not going to be here. So you got to figure it out, and you got to figure it out, by the way, really, really quickly, or you're going to be back in AAA. And things like that were throwing a first pitch breaking ball for a strike. That wasn't a strength of mine, but Yadi made me be able to do that in situations that were huge situations. If I got a guy 1-0 or 2-0, I never wanted to throw a curveball for a strike, and he would force me to do that. And it was something I had to work really, really hard at. I never really kind of got it, but I had to take a different approach. I had to figure out a different way to do it, because that was something that was, you know, going to help me and be successful. So he pushed me out of my comfort zone, but that's because he knew what it would take for me to be successful at that level.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Kyle McClellan is our guest on KMOX Profiles. I'm Tom Ackerman, and Kyle grew up in North County, in Florissant, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact, and ended up with the St. Louis Cardinals. That road was some road, and as a matter of fact, I can just picture you, little Kyle McClellan, working as a kid, trying to understand the game and thinking, because we all did growing up in St. Louis, thinking about being a Cardinal, what that would be like. Was that and was that part of your upbringing, and when did that start to become a reality that maybe you can do this?
Yeah, for me, I mean, as a kid, I was a huge Cardinals fan. My dad worked for Oscar Mayer his whole career and had season tickets down there, so he was in charge of season tickets for his company. So I think we had, you know, 16 to 20 games a year that he would get, and a lot of those I would go to, and I'd be the kid that, you know, I would make him go down there early because I wanted to get autographs, and I'd sit down by the dugout and get autographs of guys and visiting team, home team, it didn't matter. I just loved being down at the ballpark, and that was just part of our family. My sister loved it, my brother loved it, my mom loved it. You know, we spent a lot of time together at the ballpark. And
which teams were these? Who were your favorites?
You know, everybody asked me that when I first got up. Who's your favorite Cardinal ever? I didn't really have one. I mean, I just loved, if you wore a Cardinal uniform, I was a fan. Yeah. You know, I was a big fan. And, you know, if I really had to pin one down, I would say Ozzy. You know, I mean, I would probably be my favorite, but not a, you know, it didn't stand out to me. I liked everybody. I liked going down there. I mean, I watched Ray Langford hit probably every single one of his home runs at Busch Stadium. I probably got to see, you know, on TV or listen on radio or there in real life. So I was just a big fan of those, you know, 90s teams. And I graduated in 2002. So my buddies and I, we would go down and at Old Busch, and I always save my tickets. And so I would save tickets of the good seats where my dad had the season tickets. And my buddy and I, we would go buy bleacher seats for $5. And we'd go hit like Jack in the Box on the way in, so we didn't have to spend money in the stadium. And then we get down there and we get in for $5, but I would take my old ticket stub, and that's when you could just kind of flash your ticket to the usher, and we would flash the old one. I'd cover up who they were supposed to be playing because it was maybe last year's ticket or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we get down and we'd wait and we'd, you know, find seats that were open, and we'd go sneak down in there and hope we didn't get kicked out. And sometimes we got kicked out 3, 4, 5 different times, and we move around, but we always got to sit down close, and we parked for free. We walked, you know, 2 miles to get to our car. And, you know, those are me and my, we would just go. We loved baseball. And once I got into high school, you know, my sophomore year, I made our varsity team as a sophomore. And that's, I think, when I started to realize that I might be able to go to college and play baseball. I played football, I played basketball, I played baseball in high school, but baseball was always my best sport. And my junior year, I kind of took a big jump, had an opportunity to go to Mizzou, sign a scholarship to go to Mizzou. And then from my junior to senior year, I made a really big jump from throwing 89 to throwing, you know, low to mid 90s. And that's when it became a reality that I had a lot of scouts show up, 30-something scouts show up at my first game my senior year in high school. And I thought, yeah, there's a chance I might be able to, you know, get into professional ball. And the chances that it was going to be the Cardinals and, you know, all of that, it's kind of like a fairy tale story that they were the ones that ended up drafting me and ended up signing there, passing up my opportunity at University of Missouri to pursue that. And, you know, how the ups and downs of the minor leagues all played out and how it all worked out, I have no idea. One day I'm going to I'm going to have to pull up a chair next to the big guy and ask him, you know, kind of, can you go back through that with me and see how all that played out?
How did that, what was that like, the signing that first contract?
You know, it was, I was 17 years old. I was young for my age and when I was drafted and there's a lot. I mean, you're having to make your decision. Do I go, I have a scholarship here. Do I do that? Or do I go into the professional field? And we had never had any experience. I didn't have an advisor at the time. And so it was just me and my dad and my family. And ultimately we came down to, we felt like our best opportunity to make it to the major leagues was through professional ball. I just felt like sometimes college can be about winning. And if I go there, I'm one of the better pitchers on the staff. If I get used more and could potentially cause damage, where on the professional side, we felt like they were going to protect me and have my best long-term interest at heart. I will tell you that I think a lot differently now. If my son, I would say if my son was in my situation, he would go to college because I've seen everything play out and I've seen the statistics and I've seen how hard it is, especially for a high school kid to make it to the major leagues and then have a career that lasts long enough to be able to end that career at some point and not need and rely on that college education to continue things. And it's a tough thing. I mean, you sign as a 17 or 18 year old kid, you go into the real world, you're playing with 20, 21 year olds that came out of polished universities. You're used to being the best guy that steps on the field. I mean, in high school, if I stepped on the field, I was typically, not in an arrogant way, but I was probably the best player out there. Mm-hmm. You go to professional ball and you're not even close to that, you know, and now all of a sudden you have to make that adjustment again quickly. There's expectation, there's pressure, there's all these different things. And now you're living on your own for the first time. You know, there's a lot of different things that go into it. It is a whole lot to put on an 18-year-old to say you have to adapt to all these other things. And by the way, you have to be successful professionally when you don't know what it's like to be professional. I mean, you have to learn all that. You're just a kid that's going to make mistakes. And ultimately, your next few years are going to determine if you're able to make it or not.
What about the call to the big leagues? How did that happen?
Yeah, that was so I spent 6 years in the minor leagues. I had two arm surgeries, and I was terrible in the minor leagues. Like, I was really bad early on. I was bad to the point where I was about to quit. And when I was going through after coming back from two arm surgeries and things weren't going well, I ended up sticking it out and I got a break. I caught a break and had the opportunity to go over to High A and show what I could do. I had a very short window and I went over there and made the most of it. And then shortly after I got called up to Double A, things just started going. I was 22 years old at the time. I've been 5 years in. It finally started to click for me. And had I have not gotten that opportunity, I was going to be released pretty. I've been told my name was on the board to be cut a couple times and I had a couple coaches stick up for me and keep me there. So it was a grind. And then when you start to do well, sometimes you don't really know why you're doing well. You just know that you're rolling and you don't want to change anything and keep it going. And so I got invited. I got put on the 40-man roster kind of out of nowhere, to be honest with you. The year before, I was in rehab. And I go into spring training. I remember going into spring training and I talked to Dyer Miller, who called me and after I got put on the 40-man and just kind of talked to me before spring training. And he said, "What's your plan?" I said, "My plan is to go in and let them know who I am. So at some point, hopefully I'm in AAA this year, and at some point when they need somebody, they can count on me, and they know what they're going to get when they get me. And so I'm trying to make an impression. That's my impression I'm trying to make. I want to be the first guy they go to when they need somebody, because over the course of the year, you're going to need another reliever." And so that was what I went into to spring training to do. And I actually went down 2 weeks early and to my first spring training, and I said, I'm gonna pay for whatever, I'm going to get down there. I just want to get down there and get settled. And that's where I made the team. Dave Duncan was down there and I went in and I said, it was my first time to throw a bullpen down there. And he came out and watched me and there was nobody else there. It was just me and a catcher. And I threw the best bullpen I've ever thrown. And I have been groomed. The Cardinals do a great job. They had at the time, Dave Duncan's philosophy was being taught in rookie ball. I mean, it was all the way down. So by the time I got to the big leagues and big league camp, I knew exactly what he wanted me to do. It was whether or not I could execute it. And I went in there and I pounded sinkers. I could not miss. And I just kept throwing them because he's standing behind me. I know he likes it. So I'm like, I'm just going to keep throwing it. And then I always had a good curveball, so I'd show my curveball, and then I'd go back to my sinker, and I'd show a cutter, and I'd go back to my sinker.
Are you determining what you throw, or is he telling you?
No, I am. Okay. Dave Duncan was one that didn't say very much. He would just watch. And so I knew I was putting on a show for myself, and I'm like, he's got to like this. And I think I got put on the radar at that point. He said, hey, I want to kind of see what this guy can do. And so they challenged me. My first appearance was a start in Major League Spring Training, which doesn't happen very often. Joel Pinheiro pulled his hamstring. I kind of started in his place, and I went out there against the Marlins, scared to death. You know, my first time ever facing big league hitters, and it was like the big league lineup. Did well, kept getting more and more opportunities, and it kept getting down. You know, the locker room in spring training, I was number 68 and on the far side, and everybody, they kept making cuts, and my side of the room kept getting more empty and more empty, and then all of a sudden, I'm like the only guy over there looking across the locker room at the major league team. And there was four of us left for one spot, and I knew I had a chance. And I'm out playing catch one day, and I get done playing catch, and Dave Duncan comes over to me, and he says, hey, I know you probably need to make plans, but you're going with us. And he walked away, and I didn't know what that meant because we were playing Springfield in an exhibition game, and I'm like, am I going to Springfield, then you're going to leave me there, or going to Springfield, then you're going to send me to Memphis? And so... Then players came up and they knew. They came up and kind of congratulated me. And we were out doing drills, and I couldn't say anything because I couldn't call anybody. I couldn't do anything. I have to keep this in because we have, you know, practice to go through. And so then I finally go in. I call one of my mentors, one of my coaches that was a mentor. I call my dad, call my wife. Not in that order. I call my wife, then my dad, then the mentor. And then, you know, it was a thrill to know that I had no chance to make that team in spring training, and things just happened. I knew I had a short window. I was going to have a couple weeks. We opened our home opener was in St. Louis. So my major league debut was here in St. Louis, in front of all my friends and family. And, you know, it was remarkable. And I thought, to be honest with you, I thought I had 2 weeks until Pinheiro came off the DL and I'd be sent down, but I did well in those 2 weeks. And 5 years later, I never went down. I stayed up with the team for 5 years after that.
I can't even imagine what that's like to make your debut wearing a Cardinal uniform. That had to have been just like an out-of-body experience.
It was, but you really have to put yourself in a bubble. You know, facing, there'd be guys that you would face that you're like, man, I should be saying, I can't believe I'm facing this guy. And to be honest with you, my mentality was always like, I should be facing this guy.
Yeah.
I deserve to be facing this guy, and I'm better than this guy. You know, that was always your approach. You had to convince yourself. You couldn't allow yourself. And it kind of stinks because you wish you could, especially now, like looking back, there's moments I wish I would have enjoyed more, but you can't. You can't allow yourself to take it in at times because it could take you off of your game. And if you're 1% off of your game, that's the difference between winning and losing and making it and not. And so I always had that guard up. I don't want to say I wish I didn't. I mean, I had to be successful, but there's things in moments that I wish I was able to take in a little bit more and enjoy. But I enjoyed the heck out of the 5 years, so you know, there's no regrets on it.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX.
You're listening to KMOX Profiles, and Kyle McClellan is with us. I'm Tom Ackerman, the former Cardinal, kind enough to join us as we talk about his career. And we were talking about your major league debut, and I want to talk about your friendship and really partnership with Adam Wainwright and the things that you do and will continue to do for not only St. Louis but for the world. But before we do that, I want to cap your playing career by talking about 2011, because there are a lot of things that happened. I mean, first of all, Adam goes down with an injury, Tommy John, and because of that, there is an opening in the rotation. You're competing for the fifth spot in the rotation, and we all know 2011 is a special year, and we'll get to that in just a moment about how that finished for the team. But I've told you many times, I remember, I still have reports that I did documenting that was one of the big topics in spring training, was competing for a spot in the rotation. Same mentality. You have to tell yourself, that's mine. I can do this.
Yeah. And so 2010, you go back to 2010 spring training, I came in to compete as a starter, and me and Jaime Garcia, and we both had really good springs.
You did.
And I got called in, Tony called me in, and Dunk called me in, and we had the conversation. And the problem was, they had told me I won the starting spot. unfortunately, because of my role in the bullpen, they weren't able to award me that starting rotation job. So there was a little conflict amongst everyone of where I should go. Ultimately, they said, you had a great spring. You should have won the starting job, but we can't lose you in your role in what you do in the bullpen. So I went to the bullpen and had my best year I've ever had that year out of the bullpen. Every year I came into spring training preparing as a starter. I threw four pitches out of the bullpen too, so it always actually helped me be ready to throw those four pitches when season started. But every spring I came in as a starting pitcher. 2011, I come in and they said, you are a reliever. You are not going to be a starting pitcher. Come in ready to go as a reliever. And so I did, and very early in, it was one of the first few days of spring training. I'm actually in the training room getting stretched, and they come in. I had no idea about it, and they came in and said, Adam, you know, had a bad bullpen, and his elbow's not good. They got to go look at it. And the trainer said, get ready to start. And they did. They came to me and said, we're gonna quickly stretch you out, which I was always fine. It didn't take me long to get ready. And so it's just ironic, the one spring that I went in totally, you know, set on being a bullpen guy, I end up, you know, being a starting pitcher. But yeah, it was a big thing. And it was hard for me because I didn't, you know, I've been down that road before. And so I didn't want to get my hopes up. And I had conversations with Moselock and Tony and everybody. One of my things was there were some free agents out there, and I didn't want to, you know, start to ramp this up. And then a week left in spring training, I show up and there's one of these free agents sitting in the locker room that is going to do that. And, you know, I was pretty much told that, hey, we're going to give you a long leash here and see what you're able to do. And there were some other people competing for it as well. I think PJ Walters at the time was in there and some other guys. And so it was a good, healthy competition and ended up getting the opportunity. And I always wanted to start. I love my role in the bullpen. I loved it. But I always, you know, in the minor leagues, I was a starter and I wasn't good. And I always had this in the back of my head, like, I know I can do that. I think I can do that. And to be able to do it here at the major league level was something I always wanted an opportunity to do. So I was excited to get that opportunity and to be in the starting rotation there in 2011.
2011, a world championship for the Cardinals. Their 11th, David Freese with the triple, David Freese the home run. Before that, Lance Berkman with the hit, all happened in Game 6. Game 7, Chris Carpenter on 3 days rest. Terrific. Cardinals beat the Rangers. It was a very special year. There were so many things that happened to all of you. And I think about Wainwright, you know, sitting that year out, but not sitting idly by. I mean, he was a big part of that, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. It was opening day, I think, and he came in, and his wife had bought him a cheerleading outfit, and he came in and had a full-blown cheerleading outfit. I don't know if he had the wig on or not, but he had pom-poms and everything, and he, you know, after people laughed, he just said, hey, I'm here for you guys. I'm here. I'm your biggest cheerleader. And I'm going to be here the whole way for you guys as you guys go out and dominate. And I'm going to be doing my rehab, and I'll be back next year. But I'm here for you guys. And, you know, he's a guy that regardless of how he's doing on the field, he's a guy you want around. I mean, he's a guy that I'm glad his rehab was here in St. Louis and not in Florida because, you know, without him, we don't win that World Series. Just his knowledge and his mentorship and all these different things that he provides, not just on the mound, but all the things he does that people don't see. You know, without him that year, we don't win the World Series.
Adam and you have put together what I think is going to be your legacy. And I told Adam that. I said, you know, your baseball career is just part of your legacy. What you're doing in Haiti and what you're doing for people around the world is going to be a big part of it. And he looked at me and he said, have you been there? Have you been to Haiti? And he said, you need to go. Kyle, when we go to Haiti, and you've been, what, now 20 times?
Yeah, 20-something times.
What do we see?
Man, it's hard to describe. So Haiti's a place. I had no idea. We went on our first trip in January of 14 with Adam and his wife. Me and my wife went, and Scott Linebrink, another former teammate of ours, and a group of people, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I knew I always wanted to do a trip like that. Always honestly use baseball as an excuse not to go. And I can't be traveling a third world country right before the season. What if I get hurt? What if I get sick? I can't work out. You know, all these different things I would kind of use as a crutch. And when I was done playing, or I was going through surgery, and a free agent, you know, Adam had invited us to go. And It was eye-opening. I mean, I just knew I was going on a trip with some of my buddies and friends and a guy that's kind of been championing this project for the last 20 years that I knew well through the relationship with the Pittsburgh Pirates. And when you land at the airport and get in the car, you've never seen anything like it. You know, just the drive to where we were staying, it's a 20-minute, like, jaw-dropping experience. And it's funny now when I go, we've taken over 300-400 people over the years, and I love watching them experience that. And then at night we sit around and talk, you know, we play the high-low game, what's your high of the day, low of the day, and the first time it's always that drive. I mean, it's just, there's nothing like it. You can see it on TV, you can hear about it, you can whatever, but until you experience and you smell it and you see it, it just doesn't really grab you. And I've just never seen that many people with nowhere to go, but they're all going somewhere and they live on next to nothing. I mean, these people wake up every day and have to survive. They wake up every day and say, what do I do today to survive, to make it to tomorrow? And, you know, that's a situation that I've never been in. I know there's people here that struggle in the United States. I'm well aware of that. We're in some of those areas, but, never seen it like this. I mean, it's a level of poverty that you can't describe.
So what did you and Adam and everybody else decide you were going to do to make it better?
Well, Adam and Jenny had gotten involved and they helped build this orphanage a couple years before we were there. And we were on the trip to see if it was something they wanted to continue to invest in or if it didn't turn out. You know, the international is tough. A lot of money is sent there and maybe not used like you would want it to. And so that's what we were there to kind of check on how this is all set up. And when we got there, the thing that really grabbed us, my wife and I were looking in St. Louis for 3 years for something to get involved in, and we couldn't find it. We looked and looked and looked and looked. I'm very hands-on. I had a certain way that I wanted our funds to be invested, and we just didn't find the right match. And when we went to Haiti, we found it. And I was very, not against, but I wanted our help to be in St. Louis. I was not looking to leave St. Louis because this is where I'm from. This is where we wanted to do it. But what Haiti had to offer, I couldn't find in St. Louis at the time. And we learned a ton through our time there. The leadership and the infrastructure that was set up and in place there was incredible. And so we just said, hey, we can really maximize our investment here. I always look at our giving just like you would your finances. You want to get the most on your investment, and the same as should be true for in terms of your giving. And so we just said, hey, how can we help? And from that point on, we locked in. Adam and Jenny locked in. Adam's foundation's been involved, the other partner that's been working down there for a long time. So since then, Adam and Jenny have built a school. They've built a hospital. They've done a lot of water and sanitation. We built the second level of the orphanage, and then we help with a lot of the day-to-day expenses of those buildings. So we have 197 kids that we send to school. We have a school feeding program that our organization provides for. The hospital is run by a kid that grew up in our orphanage that serves. He sees 78 patients a day on average. They have a community health program that sees 200 people out in the community every day, over 80 trained professionals there through the community health in the hospital. We've created 450 jobs for local people, water and sanitation. You know, 35,000 people have clean drinking water. 1,000 toilets have been put in the community. We're building a vocational school right now. So we touch about 40,000 people a day in this community. And in a way that the community development really all working together to provide tons of different opportunity and the ability for kids to grow up in a successful environment so that when they become adults, they can then lead their families and their community in a different direction.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Final few minutes on KMOX Profiles with Kyle McClellan. It's Brace for Impact 46 is the foundation that Kyle and his wife Bridget have been working with Adam Wainwright and Jenny Wainwright with their foundation, and they have really done amazing work together. And in our final few moments, I do want to talk about what's going to be a great event at Busch Stadium on August 17th, where you will not only be raising funds for your impact in Haiti, but also, and you touched on this a little while ago, that, you know, we know that here in St. Louis, there are people that are struggling day to day, and you have made a great effort to work in our community, especially here in the city, to make life better for people and to try to improve the community. What are you doing there, and what can we do to help on August 17th?
Yeah, so we learned a ton through our time in Haiti, and I don't think it's a mistake or a not a mistake. I think there's a lot of reasons that we went to Haiti first. And the reason is because we needed a lot to learn. We would have come to St. Louis, we would have failed. And a lot of the reasons is I didn't have the understanding in how to help in a way that benefits the people you're trying to help. I think my mentality would have been, we're funding this. This is our idea. This is our vision. This is what you need. And what we learned in Haiti is how to trust local leadership and really listen to what the people need that you're helping. I think a lot of mistakes that I see in the nonprofit world are people that come in and try to tell people how they need to do things. And it just doesn't work that way. If you're going to come into a community you don't have knowledge of, you need to listen to those people and find how you can plug into what they need. And so we really learned that. We found an amazing partner here in St. Louis. And so we're doing community development here in St. Louis in the inner city. We focus on the purchase and renovation of homes. We hire local contractors. So we've hired over 100 contractors through our time rehabbing these houses. And once the homes are done, we place families in them through a long application and interview process. And we work hand in hand with those families. So once we place those families in the home, we work with them on a daily basis to make sure that they're stabilized and make sure that they have the things that they need to be successful for them, but ultimately their kids. And if we can stabilize the parents, we can get the kids in a stable environment. You know, on average, people move 2 to 3 times per year in these communities, and it's just hard on the kids. So if we can stabilize that, we can get the kids plugged in. There is some give back. The families have to be involved in a couple of our programs for this. They also pay rent. So that there's a lot of different accountability and buyback into this. But what we've seen is the communities is evolving and benefiting because there's jobs created and there's progress being made. You know, I tell people all the time, when you walk out of your house, if you don't ever see progress, if you see negativity and dilapidated buildings and graffiti and drugs and violence and all these different things, you never see anything get better, it kills your hope. You have to have hope. And when these kids walk out, we want them to see that their community is thriving and benefiting and turning over and getting better. And if we can do that, it's going to burn that vision and impression on those children that they're in a place that they can do better. They can have better outcomes and results. And we're going to be there every step of the way to make sure that they have those opportunities. So St. Louis has been a really fun project for us. It's totally different than Haiti, but it's exactly the same. And we've learned a lot there. We have great leadership. And so, we're doing our first gala for our organization in August, and we're going to come together and raise funds and have people learn about our organization on a deeper level of what we do. You know, we've been very quiet about our work in St. Louis for a lot of different reasons. And so I think there's going to be a lot of people kind of blown away with the results we've had, with the things we've done, and the things we've been able to achieve in a short amount of time.
And I know we have a lot of business leaders listening right now and probably asking, does he have the financial backing that he needs? I can tell you that it has been on its way. And there are a number of companies and corporate support that has been coming Kyle's way. And if you'd like to get involved, Brace for Impact 46, probably the best way is through your Facebook page, is it not?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways. Facebook and Instagram is our best way. We keep people up to date on what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. People can reach out on our website. We have a contact us on there, but it has been. So we fund both of those projects differently. We're one organization and we have two separate bank accounts. So if you go online and people want to support Haiti or they want to support only St. Louis, you can select that. And those funds go to those direct accounts and they don't cross over. And St. Louis, we are supported very heavily by a lot of the corporations here in St. Louis. And we've grown a very impressive list over the years. Over the 2 years of what we're doing, and we look to and can't wait to grow that even more. The Haiti side, we're really grassroots funded. You know, a lot of people that do fundraisers for us or donate $10, $15, $20, $50, $100. That's really how we make things run on the Haiti side. But both have grown great, and it's great because our donors don't compete against each other. You know, a lot of people are passionate about you know, international help. A lot of people are passionate about St. Louis. They can pick their spot. And, you know, we're grateful either way. We don't pin either program against each other. I tell people, I think it's kind of rare, but we are equally passionate about both of our projects. I think if you had the time to sit down and talk with me about it, you can see the passion that we have for both. We love both projects, and we know that we're getting a great return on our investment on both of those as well.
Thanks for what you do, and thanks for dropping in and doing this KMOX profile, and we'll continue to spread the word about everything that you're doing.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Tom.
Absolutely. Kyle McClellan, the former Cardinal with us. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ackerman in this edition of KMOX Profiles.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click On Demand.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.